Hi listeners, welcome back to episode 57 of the Get Cyber Resilient Show podcast. I'm Dan McDermott and today we'll be looking at the industry news. I chat with our resident cybersecurity experts, Brad and Gar, following the theme of ransom and disruption. Today we'll be looking at the hack that has brought down Australia's largest meat processor. Then we'll head over to the US and take a look at the latest hack that occurred on the New York subway. Then back on our local shores to look at Australian media organisations and how they're looking to protect themselves since the Nine attack, and results of a local government audit and councils across New South Wales and their preparedness for cyber. So we'll kick off today with from recording from lockdown again in Melbourne. So Brad and I are certainly suffering our way through that. And as we said, we'll kick off with the latest hack that's happened on the meat processor JBS. But we have seen in lockdown that again, we've noticed panic buying. So again, we see a shortage of toilet paper here in Melbourne. The meat aisles are already pretty sparse when you head into the supermarkets. And now we've seen the world of cyber actually make that even worse again. Brad, what can you tell us about what's happened to JBS and the impacts on local meat supply?
It's like another day, another piece of ransomware, another breach we hear about, Dan. But I think the one thing I'm concerned about, and I think you messaged me this morning, you're like, make sure you go get your Maccas while you still can, because Maccas are going to run out of meat. It's that, you know, look, if we think about, I guess, the shift in terms of the way our businesses are designed to, you know, provide things just in time, it really is you know, it's almost come at the cost of resilience, because when things stop just for a split second or just for a day, the amount of disruption is absolutely phenomenal. Now, in terms of the breach we're talking about, so it's made all the headlines for all the wrong reasons, of course, but it was an attack against a multinational company called JBS. They've got abattoirs all around Australia, all around the US. I think in Australia, they employ well above 10,000 people, so a massive employer. But estimated yesterday, due to the disruption, there was about 8,500 head of cattle and 6,500 sheep, which were scheduled to be processed, but they couldn't process them. So yeah, there's a lot of news or a lot of thinking that this is going to lead to some certain disruption that the consumer will feel.
It's such an interesting word, processing. I feel like that means something else in this context. But anyway, I think you're spot on, Bradley. Like the whole resilience thing when it comes to just-in-time delivery and supply chain, it wasn't just this, right? But COVID was the same thing, when you kind of realize actually how much stuff arrives on shore from other places through very complex supply chains. And then, you know, something goes wrong, like something as small as our borders shutting, and all of a sudden, you know, the panic buying does start. It's definitely an interesting one. And you know, the focus is obviously on JBS, but there's going to be presumably a lot of sort of broader impact to farmers. You know, those cattle and sheep come from somewhere. And, you know, like I don't really know how this stuff works, but presumably they'll have to stay on land and be fed, and that has costs associated with. So, you know, it's not just JBS, but it's actually rural communities who are already so hard hit in Australia with through drought and everything else, and that, you know, for those folk who are waiting to ship out cattle, they're probably sitting on land, costing money, and you know, not getting cash turnover for folks who probably need it. So yeah, definitely an interesting one.
You can't like store things that long anymore, right? Like just the way that I guess the world has kind of changed. Okay, back to kind of just in time or just in time supply or provisioning, but you know, for a farmer to have an extra 1,000 cattle sitting on his farm or property for 2 months, like the cost of feed, to your point, guys, absolutely phenomenal. And it comes all back down to the consumer too, right? From the delivery, from the retailers to the end consumer, as us as an example eating meat, it affects just every single part of that also delicate supply chain, which is what we've learned through just COVID. Like disruption happens, right? Bad things happen. Like you have to a degree, they're not the reason for the fault, they happen. So how do we plan for them and be more resilient?
Yeah, is it sort of buffers? Is it buffers in the supply chain? Because that has costs, and you know, ultimately end consumers will have to pay for that. Although the toilet paper one was interesting, because from what I understood, it was actually the cost of storing toilet paper is extraordinarily high because it's so big, you know, compared to the weight. So you know, you buy a 48 pack of toilet paper. It takes up a huge amount of space on shelves, but also in the back end storerooms for supermarkets. So they wouldn't, you know, obviously then they wouldn't store that stuff. And those central locations. Here's the thing, given Australia's massive amount of space, you know, as you kind of move further towards the center, I mean, I wonder, is there opportunities for regional buffers or resilient storage centers for things that we need in our supply chain, if you could figure out a way to store them. I mean, when it comes to meat, unless it's in jerky form, you're probably not in a good position, because then you got to pay for refrigeration and all that stuff. But yeah, it's a really interesting one. It's out of the, you know, we've already said it, outside of the cybersecurity stuff. I think, COVID's, it's been a massive lesson just in terms of how brittle and exposed, not just, I mean, it's not an Australian problem, right? It's global, but how brittle the supply chains actually are. And it reminds me of the whole butterfly flapping its wings, causing a tornado across the world. And it sort of feels a little bit like that at the moment.
Like, you make such a good point there about geography as well. Like, buffer zones, you know, that's such an interesting idea. And we think about where things like manufacturing evolved originally. It was in countries like Japan, which had incredibly small geographics. So the idea of supplying something just in time is completely fine. But in Australia, historically, it's quite hard because we rely on so much ports, you know, stuff coming in from the outside world going in. But if, you know, I think to your point, Guy, like, it does make us think, how do we make this more resilient at a national level and kind of within Australia?
And also manufacturing onshore. Because it's a little bit odd, but I got friends who went into business making men's underwear. And it's odd, right, to get it, but they were, you know, high ends, very appealing to a certain type of demographic. And when they went to try and source the raw materials, so, you know, cotton and fabrics in Australia, that just is nearly impossible to do these days. And I suspect it's probably the same for many things, where when you look at the map of supply chain, the thing, you know, we send the things we buy overseas. You know, there's these weird things, like it's like a boomerang where we make it on shore, we send it overseas, and then we have it packed there and then sent back to Australia, and then some things we just don't make at all. So yeah, it's quite bizarre.
I think it's also an example of another attack that's having societal impacts, right? We spoke last time about Colonial Pipeline and what we saw in the US, and with people queuing and doing strange things of trying to store petrol, right? You know, these things do have a real impact on everybody. And, you know, certainly I'll be heading out to Macca's after this and that, because, you know, you just don't know when you might get it again, but also just, you know, the cost of living as well. And I think that the idea of building in those sort of resilience factors are great, Gar, but the economics is always the challenge then, right? It's like, how does that get funded? And then, like, I mean, you've already seen the cost of lamb is pretty high these days as it is. You know, sort of driving that up is something that then doesn't become sort of affordable for people either. So the implications are really big, and I think are ongoing in terms of this, and obviously no easy answers in that. But there's certainly, we've got to make sure that, you know, resilience, as you said at the start, Brad, is at, I guess, the core of what people are thinking about. Because if you think through that and have sort of, you know, different scenarios play out, you're able to, I guess, be better prepared. But hopefully JBS are back processing soon. I think they've said that they're actually dealing with it quite quickly and looking to get systems back online as soon as possible.
I think they're back up and running already to a degree, yeah.
I was just to say, are we at a point where we need to have a segment for preppers on the show? You know, that we talk about, like, the latest offerings in canned goods and weaponry for when the apocalypse comes. It's starting to feel that way.
Yeah, I'm sure you've got your stash out the back there, Guy, with the tinfoil everything all ready to go.
This is 10% of our listener base.
Yeah, it's definitely an interesting story, one that will continue to evolve. But again, the fragility of supply chains, the societal impact that it does have, both upstream, as you said, to the farmers, and downstream to consumers, is massive, and something that, we'll definitely keep an eye on. And unfortunately, I'm sure in fortnight's time, when we come back together, there'll be another example to talk about, because it just keeps hitting the news on a daily basis. As we said, we'll then have a look over stateside and take a look at the New York subway system hack that occurred. I think, Gar, I think you're going to kick us off with a joke, weren't you?
Oh, yeah, I am. I have to. I'm sorry. I don't even have kids, and yet I make the dad jokes. So when Brad sent over this story, I initially thought, like, is this the fast food chain? Because I think it was the Macca's thing had been put in my head. So, you know, I was thinking, like, New York is going to be in a panic if, subway sandwiches aren't available. People will be freaking out completely. It's not. Apparently, it's a transit system.
I'll definitely add that to the dad joke repertoire.
So, thanks, Dan.
Thank you. And Brad, what can you tell us what actually happened here in New York?
Yeah, look, and to be honest, when I was reading the story originally, I was a bit confused because I saw MTA everywhere and I was thinking mail transfer agent, but it's Metropolitan Transportation Authority. So we're both a bit confused there, Gar. So this is an interesting attack, and the fact that it doesn't look like it really did much damage or any damage, but I guess effectively it suggested there was a foreign government which effectively gained access to 18 databases of the New York subway system. They're saying the hackers didn't access any train controls or anything to that effect, but it was linked to a foreign entity. It's quite interesting if you think about like maybe some of the reasons behind it. Like there's been a lot of nationalization around our train systems and like the manufacturing aspect of that as well, as a lot of countries around the world, you know, rush to rail, lay rail as well. But I think it's just another example where, you know, this is a core system. It's critical infrastructure. How is this stuff then protected? And, you know, what's the onus on the organizations? There was a survey or study conducted by Mineta Transport Institute, which found that only 60% of transportation agencies surveyed had a cybersecurity plan in place, despite 80% saying that they felt prepared to manage such threats, which I'm sure we can do the math on that one.
Yeah, something doesn't add up there, does it? It's a little bit concerning. Yeah, transport is one of those, it's kind of an interesting one. You know, the transport communication, those, you know, almost back to critical infrastructure conversations. It's amazing to me how potentially vulnerable so much of that stuff can be. And, you know, this is obviously about trains, but we've seen many stories that are sometimes cyber attacks, but actually sometimes just computer failure where airlines are brought down because their booking systems go askew or, you know, those sort of central coordinating systems for, you know, ATC and airlines. I really don't know what the answer is here other than kind of rethinking the whole resilience aspect of things like transport. And one of the things I kind of come back to is, and this is probably naive on my part, but like, what is the core requirement for this stuff to be connected in a way that means it's attackable? Because in my mind, you know, something like a transport system doesn't, I mean, again, I don't work in transport, so I'm probably getting this wrong, but like, I don't know why you would necessarily need it connected externally in a way that makes it attackable. Like if it was fully air gapped, which doesn't make it impenetrable, but, you know, it's a sort of isolated, segmented system, you know, almost zero trust at a transport level, where you could maybe mitigate some of the risk. And again, you know, it's impossible to mitigate all the risk, but I feel like so many of the ICS transports, manufacturing systems, they're connected. And I'm often wondering, yes, I get there are reasons why you would do that, but are we at a point where the reasons you would do that are far outweighed by the risk that's presented when attacks are successful and brought, you know, bringing down manufacturing, transport, healthcare, you know, all the systems that we talk about, seems like every week, you know, in the risk analysis, are we at a point where we go back to fully air gapping systems that are completely critical? That's probably me being completely naive in terms of the reasons that you connect these systems.
I'm thinking you just run like a LAN cable under each train line or something, or tram line in Melbourne as an example, and then that's like the private network. But I remember watching something on, Metro Trains, and it was about a role or position where basically you're like the master train controller of Melbourne, right? So you sit in this room above Flinders Street Station, and it's like being an air traffic controller. So you're seeing all the trains, you're moving them around, clicking on these buttons. Like, what's the resilience behind those systems? Like, if that stopped tomorrow, like, how quickly would we be able to get back up and running and sending people? Like, maybe we're lucky at the moment because, you know, we're stuck at home in Melbourne, but, you know, want to back up and running, like, that's the disruption is just ridiculous. It's insane.
Yeah. I think there's something around the cost, you know, as I think through this. So we did a panel last week, actually over in New Zealand, on open data and government, and I was lucky enough to talk to some very qualified people in the space, and you know, their commentary was around the utility and value of data when it came to, well, sort of with government, and that's across lots of different things. But when you think about transport, you know, sensors along the way, I suppose temperature of tracks and track warping, number of passengers, like all of that stuff is incredibly, incredibly useful data to make decisions. You know, do we need more trains or is this train running slow? So like I get all of that. And then I wonder, is the cost to do fully secure kind of private versions of that just so expensive that it's easier to hop onto, you know, public infrastructure secured by VPN or whatever? But that's your way to do that. But yeah, it's such an interesting one because I get how valuable the data sets are. and the ability to control that stuff. But I wonder, are we at a point where we need to rethink the use of public infrastructure for connectivity?
I think it's cost, Gar, and I think it's probably access to the technology as well, right? Like, as we've seen the move to cloud, and that being, I guess, a default for innovation and new solutions and the availability of some of, new applications even, then I think that, you've got to question whether, is it economical for it to be a completely closed network, both for the operator and then, I guess, for the suppliers of, some of those solutions that they're procuring as well. I guess where my head goes as well with this is the scary thought of, like, where does it end, right? Like, who are these people? What are their motives at the end of the day? And, something like transportation and that type of thing, getting into that, you can get to the point of cyber terrorism, right? I mean, it's actually possible that they take control of, the subway and who knows what can happen from there. So it's definitely scary sort of thoughts. And again, that goes to a much bigger level of concern. And like you say, Gar, what is that risk that needs to be considered in all of this? Because, if at the end of the day, it's, yes, like, identity theft is bad and money is bad and that, but obviously, loss of life is obviously so much greater. So there does need to be, I think, that risk perspective throughout all of this.
Definitely. Do you feel like, do you guys remember Superman 3 from, like, was it the 80s, maybe even the 70s? Like, so long ago now, but the one we had of Richard Pryor, and they had the supercomputer. He was an expert kind of hacker guy, and he built, I'm going to get all this wrong now, but he was a whiz. And I think he controlled a weather satellite and was creating storms. And then he...
Brainiac or...?
Oh, Superman 3, like the, the superhero movie way back. It's probably early 80s. Like, I remember I was tiny when the thing came out, but it sort of feels like it's that kind of movie. It is that, to your point, Dan, it's that. It's control of systems that have a huge, huge impact to countries. So I don't know, are we living through Superman 3? Question for the listeners.
I'll have to go back and check that out. I haven't seen it for a long time. Maybe get the kids to watch it. We'll see.
Sure, the kids, sure.
Yeah, that's right, exactly. It's a handy excuse when need be, right? So one of the most high-profile attacks in Australia this year has been on Nine Entertainment. And we've now seen that, we've actually gone to Senate estimates, and ABC and SBS have actually spoken about how they now proactively looking at what they need to do and how do they actually increase their security posture and their resilience, knowing that, that this is, a likely scenario that if it's been successful once, that they might be, next cabs off the rank, if you like. Brad, what can you tell us about what the ABC and SBS have been up to?
Yeah, I think the ABC and the SBS have recognised the disruption that Nine suffered, unfortunately, in late March. And I think even personally, maybe because I don't really watch, TV as we know it, traditional TV anymore, to me, it didn't really seem like much of a big deal. But if we look at some of the latest draft of the National Critical Infrastructure Bill, there is a lot of wording in there which talks about how do we protect our public broadcasters. And that could range from anything like a radio station out in Wollongong, as an example, all the way to a large broadcaster such as ABC or SBS. So I think it's they've obviously got the right idea behind it. They're talking about increasing, spend of $500,000 at the moment, the ABC. The ABC's operational cybersecurity costs will more than double to $3.9 million next financial year, and security is similarly eating into the budget of the SBS as well. So I think it's obviously great that they're recognising the risk of it, but I know a big plan, of a lot of broadcasters, including the ABC, is to go into a more digital space. So as they digitise, that, again, raises more questions of potential risk and, access points. I know, as an example, that you now have to sign up for an ABC account, or they're making it mandatory. So they're going to start to, collect more data on their viewership and audience.
It's funny when, you look at Nine, it's Nine Entertainment, so people think about, next top housewife model that cooks, or whatever, the sort of TV shows that are out there at the moment. But when I think of ABC, I think about the bushfires. I think about, it is a communication method for a nation. It's sort of the national, it's like the BBC in England or TE back in Ireland. They're kind of, they have an important role in terms of, news, what's happening, weather, things that I think, I'm city folk, but when you hear some of the ads on, you know, ABC, people in regional areas rely on it for weather, what's happening, news, what's happening in bushfires. Like it's actually so, so important outside of the, you know, the comedies and sitcoms and all that stuff. It's actually these, you know, and SBS isn't the same boat, I would say, but that's where my head goes. And I think about when you see those coups that happen in other countries, one of the first things that often happens is get control of the TV stations and either shut them down or take control of them. So, I mean, to me, that sort of points to the importance of these kind of broadcasters and sort of news media in general.
Indeed. I think what we have also seen and is the ASD's Director General, Rachel Noble, sort of come out in Senate estimates and say that the information that they collected from Nine has allowed them to actually start to be proactive and actually warn, and it happens to be warning two other networks, and they don't actually name who they are, but it's coincidentally that then the ABC and SBS have spoken about like what they are doing. You know, maybe join those breadcrumbs, but it's interesting what is the role of the ASD, right, and what is happening and the information intelligence that they're getting to start to be proactive in that. And you know, some really interesting articles that I certainly didn't realize, I guess, that proactive nature of what of their capability and what they are doing. And you know, and now they're talking about the fact that they actually are doing that and bringing, I guess, the information to bear in a sense to stop things happening before rather than just reacting afterwards, and how to get people back up and running.
And isn't that so good, because the cost of like heading an attack off before it happens is so much lower than remediation costs. Like economically, that to me just makes 1,000,000% sense. You know, it just seems like the right move. Interestingly, Brad and myself were chatting in another meeting, completely unrelated, but we got into the, you know, the like, how does this work? And you know, how does that ASD, how do they figure this stuff out? And one of her colleagues was talking about how some of the organizations he's worked with would have people who would spend, you know, a decade building a profile on the dark web to the point where they're really trusted and, you know, sitting in forums, understanding what's happening, you know, at a higher level, and using that as kind of intel into, yeah, I suppose, nation state attacks and private enterprise also. But it's really interesting that the ASD were able to share those IOCs prior to the attacks. I just think that is such a good news story. You know, we talk about such all the bad stuff all the time, but that is such a light at the end of the tunnel. If we can see national level organizations starting to play that role where they really do head off the attacks before they become something that is so incredibly expensive, whether that's you know, meat processing, whether that's transport, whether that's macros, whatever it is. But I think this is just an incredibly good thing to have happened.
It's good that they share the information too. Like, it sounds like, based on that media report, Dan, that they have been notifying organizations across Australia, and it's starting to grow. Like, I think a couple of healthcare providers too, and again, like back to Gar's point, like, you know, just the fact that we're going on the offensive a little bit, but we're also getting to hear a little bit about, in terms behind the scenes, you know, how is the government, how is the ASD, how are these institutions supporting businesses in Australia to tackle the threat, which we just keep hearing about, right? And I feel this is probably one of the first tangible things. And, you know, does it turn into a hotline? I mean, there's probably already a hotline, isn't there, where you can call and speed dial? There is, isn't there? Yep.
Yep.
I think it's fantastic. And I'd like to see, I think, just more examples of this. And it makes you wonder what goes on behind closed doors in terms of how we collect information, the honeypots that we may have out there as an example, and in some of the analysis and chatter that we see just on the dark web as an example.
Yes, and they spoke about, actually, as you said, healthcare and actually having people in the Department of Health from the ASD, because we've seen health as the most attacked sector, and knowing how critically important it is normally, but even more so in these times, right? And actually doing that proactive monitoring and really trying to get ahead of the game, because we've seen too many examples of where, you know, unfortunately, it's made the news because the breach has occurred. But it makes you think now, like, I wonder how many more there might have been, and how many they've been able to get ahead of that never make the news, right? Which, at the end of the day, this is, you know, hopefully our podcast can come to an end one day, because there is actually no news to talk about. This is the ultimate outcome, I think.
Don't, please, don't. That's such a scary thought.
That's a good thing. I think if anything, with the podcast may become daily one day because we have too much to talk about.
Or we just change it into, I don't know, we can figure out some other topic that we all like. Food. Let's we could do a burger podcast maybe.
Yeah, indeed. I think also flowing off the back of that though is like the scourge of ransomware, right? And we're seeing it all the time, and we've spoken about it previously. And we've also just recently seen commentary from the Shadow Assistant Minister for Communications and Cybersecurity, Tim Watts, really, I guess, saying and putting it on the agenda for the ASD to go a step further and actually start to actually look at who are those top 10 ransomware groups that are targeting Australian organisations, and how does the ASD actually get after them and make sure that there's actual, you know, things put in place to actually stop them, you know, take down their infrastructure, take down their capability, not have them financed, and ensure that they're actually, you know, cutting them off at the knees, if you like, rather than, you know, just reacting and trying to, you know, stop things as they are occurring as well. It's an interesting thought and how far, I guess, you know, the ASD could go and how far this might go in terms of actually achieving, you know, stopping this at a more holistic scale, you know, obviously out of Australia, but obviously with other, you know, international sort of cyber agencies as well.
Yeah, Tim, what is the real deal? I've heard interviews with him now, and he's definitely gained a massive amount of respect for his commentary on this stuff. Definitely, I feel like he really, really gets it, which is pretty cool. I've heard him and many other people, you know, Dimitri actually talked about this stuff, I think, on the episode 54. I probably got that number wrong, but when Dimitri was on, but his whole thing about, you know, understanding that it is a often nation state that's attacking, and that idea of being proactive and sort of making sure that you're protecting a nation. I think there's a couple of interesting points around that. And this is not my ideas. This is kind of, you know, digest of things I've heard and read, but that the solution is many things. It's not doing one thing. So, you know, the big conversation about crypto, which I've heard so much discussion about, you know, regulate that. That's the, to your point, Dan, that's chopping the legs out from underneath the beast, because it certainly makes it more difficult. The counter to that is money laundering tends to happen in the sort of regions or the jurisdictions where many of these folks are operating from anyway. So yes, it might not be through Bitcoin or Ethereum, but you're probably going to see the money muled and laundered some other way. It just makes it more difficult. But you do that, you do sort of regulations, you make it, you know, illegal. And I know there's stuff in place already about paying sanctioned organizations. You know, cool, the counter to that is it becomes a cost of doing business, so it's not necessarily the thing that fixes the problem. But the things that do is the collection of all of those things together starts to make it so that it becomes unviable. The cost for the attackers just becomes so much that it becomes not worth the risk and the, you know, the downside. So yeah, I think it's a very complex issue, but I think there's so much that we can do and should do. And I think then the combination of all of those different areas, legislation, regulation of crypto, you know, yes, better security controls, but that's never going to solve the problem. You know, a bunch of things around the human side, all of it together, you know, you start to sort of turn the dial and make it more and more difficult for, more difficult and less profitable for the attackers. But, you know, it's such a huge problem.
Just on that note as well, if anyone wants to understand the report that Tim Watts was referring to, it's a Combating Ransomware report, which was released just at the end of April by the Ransomware Task Force. I'm just looking over like the headlines for it right now, but it's everything you're talking about. It's like understanding ransomware payments, the role of cryptocurrency, a global challenge. So we'll probably share a link to this somewhere in the show notes or something, but I'd definitely give it a read, everyone listening, because it's going over all the topics we kind of talk about quite regularly.
Exactly. And while we do talk about, I guess, the sophistication of attacks and what's happening in terms of, you know, impersonations and ransomware and these things, but basic cyber hygiene is still so critical, right? And we've also just recently seen the audit come back from New South Wales councils. And unfortunately, not a flattering scorecard that they received either, Brad.
Yeah, and this is quite interesting because I was having a look at the report. So it's a financial audit report of local government for 2020 run by the Audit Office of New South Wales. And first of all, when I read that, like financial audit, I was thinking, you know, what's the relevance of cybersecurity? But you've got diagrams and infographics of areas suffering from drought, and then you've got statistics just in the next paragraph talking about the preparedness of some local governments when it comes to tackling the risk of cybersecurity. So I know that for a long time, really over the past kind of 4 to 5 years, that cybersecurity has risen a priority for local councils. But to see the auditor calling it out in a report and then also kind of singling out, I guess really highlighting that a lot of local government aren't prepared for it, you know, it's really kind of interesting to see.
Yes, am I right? We've talked about governments and audits so many times, and yeah, I really wish we could just spend more money and sort of help, especially councils, right? I mean, I think it's fair to say there's budget constraints and for obvious reasons on local councils and government in general. And I think one of the papers probably last year talked about they're competing for talent in the private sector. And it's never not been the case, to my knowledge anyway, that, you know, private sector just tends to pay more. So you tend to get better talent, and it sort of ends in this kind of reinforcing cycle where you can't build a strategy or do the right thing quite often if the folks haven't got the experience or haven't been through that before. So there might be something that we need to address around how to get good talent into these positions to build the programs. And then there is also the thing around paying for the update of legacy systems, which has been called out multiple times, where you want to do, to your point, Dan, you know, the essential aid or the basics, but actually some of the sort of legacy technology that's in place makes it really, really difficult to do that. And, you know, you're sort of beholden then to technology that doesn't let you do the essential aid. There's a cost to do that, big barrier. At some point, we need to just kind of accept that and, you know, I know I'm being idealistic here, but like pay the money, get it done, and then we can kind of move forward. But it just feels like we're constantly kicking the ball down the road.
Just on the funding, I think it's a good point, right? And we hear a lot about, hey, you know, here's $500 million towards cybersecurity. Here's, you know, another company adding more to their budget. And, you know, money doesn't always solve the problem. Like, it's obviously going to help, but targeted funding around sustainable programs which develop capabilities are things which are going to work. So, you know, potentially looking at things like cybersecurity traineeships for local government as an example, like how do we get local capability and young people involved in an industry with such a big shortage? You know, train them up, get them part of the ecosystem, and that, you know, keeps breeding itself. But, you know, simply spending $100,000 on a new firewall or signing up for a new SIEM solution, like a SIEM's a great example. SIEM's going to give you so much information, so many insights you didn't have before in a correlated place. But unless you've got somebody sitting there to analyze it, data is actually not that useful. It's almost better to have another help desk engineer who can triage phishing tickets, as an example. So we need to make sure that I think the funding is done in a clever way, which helps build capability instead of just, you know, kind of putting in stopgaps.
Definitely agree. Like that is so, so spot on. But yeah, I think where my head goes is if you're on Windows 3.1.1, like you sort of have to get that taken care of. Like that to me is,
it's like a baseline, right? Like you have to do
exactly.
Yeah.
But I think you're so right there, Brad, in terms of, but let's be honest, that's not just government. That's in general, like folks going ahead and spending money on the, you know, amazing, shiny new toy that they're just not ready to fully use. Like there's just no point in doing that. But there is definitely a point in updating, you know, to the latest version of Windows that has, you know, appropriate security patches and is still supported, and you know, an Exchange server that's maybe really old, like all of that stuff, get that done. And then, yeah, then you're at a point where, to your point, all of the training, all of that stuff starts to make sense. But, you know, the humans can't really do much if you're running systems that are just so old and so out of date.
It's hard to teach, you know, what you're not preaching, right? You got to be able to deliver before you can then build that culture.
Yeah, totally.
For sure. Well, thank you, gentlemen, for the conversation and covering these key issues again. Looking forward, Gar, who do we have for next week's episode?
It's Jenny Radcliffe, who is just an absolute pleasure to talk to. Jenny's been on Darknet Diaries. She's fairly well known, I think, in the industry as the human hacker. An amazing storyteller. Honestly, just a total pleasure. We got to do prep calls, and it was one of those ones where, you know, it's a half-hour prep call, but you could easily talk to Jenny for like an hour, 2 hours, and you just don't even notice the time going. She's focused very much on the human side, so social engineering, kind of, you know, manipulation of people to basically breach organizations. So she's less around the technical controls and very much around physical penetration of buildings, you know, getting through security guards. She has honestly just incredibly good stories. And when we stopped recording, she kind of made the nice comment that we add new material, because she does a lot of interviews, and luckily we got to some stuff that she never talked about before. So definitely for Jenny Radcliffe fans out there, and I know they're out there, including Chelsea and our team, definitely worth a listen.
Fantastic. Really looking forward to that conversation, and those stories are very entertaining and while a little frightening all at the same time. Yes. So terrific. Well, thanks again, gentlemen, and thanks all for listening, and we'll be back with you next week.